This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have in the studio with me Michael Kazin, professor of history at Georgetown and co-editor of Dissent magazine. His latest book is called American Dreamers, How the Left Changed a Nation. Michael Kazin, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks for having me.
I always like to start with a little biographical information, and deep inside this excellent book is a tidbit that you were on a commune, in a commune in Oregon in 1970. How did you get there, and then how did you get from there to academia?
Good question. Well, I was a 60s kid. I was in Students for Democratic Society in the late 60s, and SDS, as some of the listeners know, was sort of going off the rails by 1969, 1970, so I was working for a group called Liberation News Service in New York City, the sort of the left-wing AP at the time. And I didn't want to live in New York anymore. I wanted to see the West Coast, so I stuck up my thumb and got to Portland, Oregon, about 5 days later. Many adventures along the way, but we won't dwell on those. And Portland was an interesting place at the time because it had a new left that was slowly morphing into, fragmenting into a gay left, a feminist left, a black nationalist left, and
was there a violent underground left there too?
Not much, no. And so, as a white guy, a heterosexual guy, I wasn't able to find a place in this new world of identity politics, and so I went to grad school and at Portland State, and then I migrated after that. I wanted to get a PhD. I migrated to San Francisco, went to Stanford. But really, I became a historian because I wanted to figure out really what we'd done right, what we'd done wrong in many ways in the left. And that led me to studying unions a lot and led me to studying populism with a small p and a capital P as well. You know, all my career as a writer, as a historian, and as an activist, I've been trying to, you know, figure out how to change America. And history is one way of understanding that, I think.
And you wrestle with the big question, why there wasn't socialism in the United States. And, you know, do you have an answer to that?
Well, it's a long answer. There's many different reasons. One reason, I think, and it's often neglected sometimes by people on the left, is that in many ways, you know, socialism is a great ideal and a set of ideals, a set of aspirations. And Americanism, to a certain degree, takes the place of socialism for a lot of people. It's actually, Americanism stands for, in some ways, a lot of what socialism stands for, but it's very abstract. Stands for you want liberty and equality both. And if we know liberty and equality often are contradictions with one another, you know, the liberty of employers to hire and fire workers goes against the quality of workers who want to keep their jobs and want unions, for example. But in some ways, socialism is a alternative idealism to Americanism, and Americanism predates socialism. That's one reason. Lots of other reasons, too. Our political structure here works against any kind of real radical change by its nature, and also, of course, the two-party structure, which wasn't there with the Constitution, also is set up to co-opt discontent whenever possible. And also socialism, since the Bolshevik Revolution, has gotten a foreign ring to it, I think. And so it's very difficult for people to call themselves socialists, even if that is their basic ideology. That was not true before the Bolshevik Revolution. Places like Wisconsin, socialism was a serious political party and a serious movement. But since the Russian Revolution, it's been more marginal.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, we had socialist mayors in Milwaukee and elected the first socialist congressperson.
And also, too, La Crosse had a socialist mayor at one point, too.
Now, at the end, you suggest that the values of socialism we need to keep holding in our breast, the values of equality. And yet the term, you say, whatever under whatever name, is socialism too damaged a coin after Stalin and Mao?
I think it is. I mean, what's ironic is that, as you know, a lot of Republicans think Obama's a socialist. And I teach a course in the history of socialism at Georgetown to first-year students, to freshmen. And when I start the class, I ask them how many people think Obama's a socialist. 70% raise their hands. But that, by that, I mean he wants government to be a little stronger. I mean, that's, you can be a little bit socialist, like a little bit pregnant or something. So Americans are, in polls, recent polls, it shows a lot of young Americans actually like the idea of socialism, partly because they kind of like Obama. And if he's a socialist, well, maybe socialism not so bad. But if you really talked in, you know, in specifics about what socialism would mean, I think you'd have a very tough time in terms of strengthening government.
What does it mean to you?
Well, it means the most democratic, most egalitarian society one could possibly have. It is a utopian ideal, and it has nothing to do with Stalinism or Maoism or Castroism. It's not about empowering the government. It's about empowering ordinary people. But unfortunately, we do have decades and decades of history where people call themselves socialists, where like people like Kim Il-sung and Joe Stalin and Mao Zedong and other people who, to me, were undemocratic tyrants. So it's difficult to reclaim the word. Though in Europe and elsewhere in the world, the word is still used.
In Canada, too.
Yeah.
Egalitarian. How egalitarian would you make it?
The society?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't think I'd do away with capitalism completely. I think, there are positive things about prices telling you, you know, what people want, what they don't want, and entrepreneurship can be a wonderful thing if the corporations that entrepreneurs found are regulated and workers are treated well. So, I mean, I think a society looks more like Norway or Denmark, but was more friendly to immigrants than those countries are right now, would be a pretty nice place. I wouldn't want to give up a lot of the wildness of America either.
I mean, the question of, part of me would settle for real equality of opportunity, which is so far from where we are now, given the disadvantages that people have, educational and economic by birth. But we don't have that. And then there certainly can be more leveling at the top with a more progressive income tax that's been flattened since the days of Eisenhower, when top marginal rates were 91 and 92%, and they're under 40 now. So, there are ways to make equality of opportunity more real, and that it doesn't even get you to equality of outcome. But we're ways from that, and I want to explore why we're ways from that. You deal with us, Michael Kazin, who's co-editor of Dissent magazine, one of the great progressive magazines in the country. His latest book's The American Dreamers, How the Left Changed a Nation. I want to talk about this book and why you wrote it, why you wanted to reclaim some victories for the American left.
Well, really, I wanted to figure out, as I've been trying to figure out since I've been involved in politics, going on 50 years now, I guess, what the left did right, what it did wrong, what the balance sheet is, in a sense, to use a capitalist term, of the left, and to try to explain that in a fairly readable, not too long volume. It's many, many books have been written about this topic, but I couldn't find really one book that did it as a whole. And it's not just socialism either. It's also abolitionism. It's radical feminism. It's some aspects of black nationalism, all of which I think have a general egalitarian ethos and egalitarian goals. So I wrote the book to answer a question I've always had and maybe help other people to think about that question a little more.
And the conclusion you seem to draw is that while the left never took power in its own name, as you say a couple times in the book, it did manage to transform the culture or the moral culture or the political or social culture of the country. That's no minor thing.
No, not at all. And I wanted to subtitle it The Failure and Success of the American Left, but the publisher was a commercial publisher that said, don't put failure in the title. People won't buy it. the argument in the book basically is that the left has not been able to build structures of its own for the most part, not enduring ones anyway. No third parties, radical labor unions, and so forth. But it has been able to make arguments that forced Americans to look at some of the inequalities, brutalities even in American life about race, about gender, to a certain degree about class inequality, though less successful in doing that. And I think the great accomplishment of radicals in American history has been to force issues onto the public agenda, which otherwise would have been compromised before they even got onto the public agenda. And that's why we think about abolitionists, we think about Democratic socialists like those in Wisconsin who were a very important part of pushing progressives like Robert La Follette to the left, I think. And, of course, the new left in the 60s as well, which failed to produce a third party, failed to produce an enduring institution of its own, but did clearly was very important in pushing the rebirth of feminism, the gay liberation movement itself, and parts of the environmental movement. So that's, again, not a small thing, but it's not power.
You mentioned Robert La Follette, the founder of the Progressive. He doesn't appear in your book, and progressivism is touched on very lightly, sparsely. Why is that? Does that not represent left to you?
Well, I think there's, I mean, we now sometimes, partly because the country's moved to the right in the last 40 years, for the most part, we tend to think left means everybody, you know, who's, you know, say, a Democrat, a loyal Democrat, all the way over to, I don't know, Noam Chomsky or someone who's still a communist. He's not. He's an anarchist. But in history, what left means is radical left. It means people who are to the left of progressive, to the left of liberals, people who want to transform the society quite utterly. And that doesn't mean there aren't a lot of complicated relationships between them. And Robert La Follette, when he ran for president in 1924, as you know, the socialists supported him because they thought he was close enough to the kind of things they wanted, and they couldn't really see running a separate campaign to take votes away from him.
He was as far left as progressives got. He was an anti-imperialist leftist.
And he opposed the war, World War I, when that was a very radical thing to do, and he was part of a coalition against the war. But that's why. I mean, there's this history of liberalism, this history of progressivism. I wanted to write a history of the historic left, which is to the left of liberalism, progressivism, and of course, has relationships with those people, but is not the same as those folks.
Yeah, fair enough. My guest today, Michael Kazin, co-editor of Dissent Magazine, author of American Dreamers, How the Left Changed a Nation. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor of the Progressive Magazine, and I was being a little parochial there about the progressive movement.
That's fine. Writing about local's good. Local's good.
The high water mark you write in the book as far as getting close to a mass base that fended for political power was the Populist and the People's Party in the late 19th century. Why were they successful to the extent that they were, and what happened?
Well, I think the People's Party was the spear, if you will, of a very large anti-monopoly movement, which included lots of different people, different races, included very devout Christians as well as atheists. And the People's Party was strongest among small farmers in the West and the South, but they also had working class supporters. And they had a very creative program which appealed to different groups in that anti-monopoly coalition. They supported labor unions. They wanted more cooperatives in the land. They wanted the government to be stronger, but to do things which would help everybody, like nationalizing the railroads, nationalizing the telegraph and telephone. And they also spoke in an American grain. They spoke about the preamble of the People's Party in 1892, written in Omaha, not exactly a radical center these days, said that we want to restore the republic to the hands of the plain people who originated it. And now that bracketed slavery, because obviously when the republic started, it was a republic by and for white people. But at the same time, it spoke in terms of American ideals, which I think was very important. And it was an interracial movement in the South especially, even though it was not one that stood out against segregation. But there was a Colored Farmers Alliance and which supported the People's
Party.
You
know, that surprised me because I remember in high school or college reading about the Populist movement and remembering it now, three decades later or more, as racist and anti-Semitic.
Yeah, well, that's an earlier interpretation which looked at a few of the people in the People's Party. Look, anytime you have a huge movement, you're going to have some folks who are sort of unpalatable. And there were some leaders like Tom Watson, famous populist in Georgia. In the 1890s, when he was a leading populist, in fact, tried to run for vice president with William Jennings Bryan in 1896 as a populist in this fusion ticket, at the time he wouldn't have a dinner, sit down and have dinner or coffee with an African-American, but he supported the right to vote, and he appeared on rostrums at rallies with them. Later on, he became a vicious racist and anti-Semite, but
Tell me about William Jennings Bryan, because you wrote a book about him.
A biography of him, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm embarrassed to say I haven't read it, but I'm very interested in reading it and finding out more about him, and obviously he's here in this book, American Dreamers. You talk about the 1896 campaign a little bit here. Why did his political career in the People's Party collapse after that campaign?
Well, it didn't quite collapse. Actually, Tom Watson ran for president in 1908 on the People's Party ticket, though he got a few votes in Georgia's home state and nowhere else. Well, you know, the People's Party in 1896 faced a dilemma that radicals often face in American history. That is, do you compromise with liberals, progressives? At the time, it was the Democratic Party run by Bryan. It was not a populist, but a Democrat. And try to win a victory which might ensure your demands a little bit forward, or do you stand out by yourself and maybe take the risk of electing someone you don't like, which in that case was William McKinley, the Republican, who was supported by the big industrialists in the country and was very opposed to unions and very opposed to small farmers in the West and the South, opposed to the government getting stronger for people's interests. So they made the decision in the end to support Bryan because they thought most of their voters would be voting for Bryan anyway. And in the end, that meant that they helped to transform the Democratic Party, I think, and that's often forgotten. The Democratic Party had not been the liberal party in America before then. It had been the more conservative party in many cases. But after that, most populist voters ended up voting for Bryanite Democrats, some of whom were vicious racists in the South, certainly. For them, populism was for whites only, often, for the Democrats at least. And so that's what happened. They made this fatal choice to give up their third-party independence because they thought every vote they got, if they had an independent ticket, would be taken away from Bryan and would have elected McKinley. Of course, what happened was McKinley won anyway.
Speaking with Michael Kazin, he's the co-editor of Dissent magazine. I'm the editor at the Progressive magazine, Matt Rothschild, and I've been reading The Dissent since I was a puppy in college. Michael Kazin's latest book is American Dreamers, How the Left Changed a Nation. Let's talk about third parties for a second. Just looking over the history of third parties in the U.S., it's just not a very promising one, is it?
No, unfortunately. Richard Hofstadter, the great historian of populism and other things he said, third parties are like honeybees. They sting and then they die. And I think that's the history, that third parties... They're meteoric. You know, they make a real dent, a real statement, I should say, in one, sometimes two elections, and they don't usually last very long. The Socialist Party was unusual in that, and that doesn't mean that people shouldn't try to form them necessarily, but I think they should form them locally before trying to form them nationally, because. And, of course, it's important to try to pass fusion laws like they have in New York and Connecticut and I think a couple other states. So you can run a separate campaign for certain local offices, but then for governor where you're not going to win, you might support, let's say, the Democrat if you're on the left.
You mentioned the Socialist Party.
Yeah.
The heroic figure of the Socialist Party, Eugene Victor Debs, makes several appearances in the American Dreamers, this book, How the Left Changed a Nation. Describe him.
Wow. Well, he was interesting. He sort of goes against the old cliche that, you know, if you're not a socialist when you're 20, you have no heart. If you're still a socialist when you're 40, you have no brains. Because he was not a socialist when he was 20, but he didn't become a socialist until he was in his 40s, actually. He'd been a Democrat. He was in the state assembly in Indiana as a Democrat. And he was one of the leaders of a rather conservative railroad union, one of the railroad brotherhoods. And then through some strikes he was involved in, he saw that you needed an industrial union of railroad workers. He formed that. And then after this huge strike he helped to lead of railroad workers in the 1890s, which was broken, he went to jail. He emerged a radical populist and then became soon after a socialist. And he was an amazing leader. And he was a man who was beloved, talked about love, talked about how politics, socialism had to be politics of love. So he was a very empathetic figure, a great orator, who ran for president 5 times, but never thought he'd be elected, you know. But he thought that the only way to get the message of socialism out to people in America was to run for president. And in 1912, 100 years ago, he got 6% of the vote, and a lot more in some states like Wisconsin, Nevada, and Oklahoma.
you have a discussion of the current left here in the United States, or you bring it up to the present. I wanted to bring the discussion up to the present, Michael Kazin, for our last 10 minutes here. There's a description that I kind of gasped at just because it was so harsh, that we're at the nadir of the historical left right now. Do you still think that after the uprising in Wisconsin and Ohio and the Occupy movement?
Well, I should say, you know, when you publish, you publish a book. The book came out around last Labor Day, 2011, and I had to finish it in late 2010, around the time when it was clear the Republicans were going to be scoring a big victory in the midterm election. So that helped to color it. But you know, I think that certainly. In the paperback, which comes out in a few months, there's a page on Occupy. And I mentioned Wisconsin, too, I think, in there. But, you know, I was talking about the radical left doesn't really have institutions now. It has magazines like yours and mine. It has, you know, some certainly important individuals who write and do well, Naomi Klein, the late Howard Zinn, for example. And even Occupy is a wonderful uprising, but it's not yet, in my mind, a movement. It hasn't yet shown it can last the way the populist movement lasted for a while, the socialist movement lasted for a while, the civil rights movement lasted for a while. I hope it does, but if it does, it's gonna have to, you know, progress from the uprising stage to a stage where they're gonna have to form some kind of institution, some kind of group which does have leaders, which can make alliances with existing institutions, whether unions or immigrant rights groups. And some of that's happening, I think. But you know, it's still an early stage. I hope it's an early stage. I hope it wasn't this big splash last fall, which will fragment and not be able to keep generating more support and keep getting more people. Wisconsin, what happened in Wisconsin, you know, was, and it's still happening, was very inspiring in many ways. But of course, as you and your listeners know, it was an uprising to defend something which being taken away. Mm-hmm. Unlike Occupy, Occupy is talking about a new world out there, mm-hmm. and as I understand it, the Wisconsin movement is generating a lot of people to say, you know, don't take away these supports that working people have, public works especially. And so that is a very important struggle, but it's not the same as the left moving forward towards thinking about and organizing for a different kind of society.
And the We Are the 99% was a slogan that kind of embodies that kind of forward, almost utopian impulse that you write about being so necessary now.
Yes.
And it was just a perfect slogan, actually. You mentioned Howard Zinn. Boy, I thought you were so unfair to Howard Zinn in this book. Almost made me weep.
I've written a longer article, even more critical. So,
but I just don't think it's true that he just thought that working people ultimately were just going to be, you know, duped. I mean, that's almost what you say, isn't it?
Well, I mean, if you look at the book, this is People's History of the United States, of course. I mean, I wrote a much longer article for Dissent, which came out 2004, I think, after reading it. And, you know, I couldn't find any places where, yes, working people rise up and they have strikes, but in the end, they get co-opted, they get repressed. It seems that radicals are only there for Zinn as these so heroic failures. And I think that is a misreading of history. He even looks at the abolitionists as kind of pawns of the industrialists in the Republican Party. And so we could argue about Howard Zinn for a long time, but I think the best thing in Howard Zinn's book to me is the quotes from historic radicals, like Debs. He quotes Debs' wonderful speech, his last speech to the court when he was being sentenced to prison for opposing World War I. He quotes Frederick Douglass. He quotes Sojourner Truth. He quotes all kinds of other wonderful people, some of whom are not at all famous anymore. And so he did a wonderful service in doing that. And it done a wonderful service, I think, in inspiring some people to become radicals and to become activists. And that's all to the good. But as an historian, when I read his depiction, I don't see the America that I've studied there, that I know. He doesn't explain, for example, why America to a lot of people seemed like a much better place than the place they came from. Because for him, you know, there was nothing redeeming about America, no reason to conserve anything about America. I just think that doesn't explain, for example, why Americans have not been very friendly towards socialism.
He did popularize, though, this idea that there was this there were these ongoing struggles at every stage, and I think that's a very...
But that's, to me, yeah, sure, but that's the ABCs of history.
You've talked about Americanism, and so what's... And you used the phrase, you know, speaking in the American grain, and you talk... How important is it to situate ourselves as Americans? I mean, I've been one who's been very leery of and remain very leery of nationalism and even patriotism when you get right down to it. And yet you think, I seem to think that you believe that's a mistake.
Yeah, I do. You know, I think people have to stand somewhere. They have to identify with some tradition. They have to see themselves as part of history. They have to see them, they have to find their idealism somewhere. And, you know, we are part of a country. We live in a country which, of course, has many flaws. But I think the ideals of Americanism are great ideals, you know, equal opportunity, liberty for all, a sense of equal rights. And the left, when it's been successful, I think has pushed the envelope of those ideals, has quoted the Declaration of Independence and said that people in power are betraying those ideals. And to me, you know, otherwise, if we don't have that, you know, we're people on the left are basically sort of rootless cosmopolitans, to use an old phrase. You know, we identify with people around the world who support us, but there's nowhere to stand. And also, in a practical sense, if you don't identify as American, then it's difficult to say we need to organize a majority of people to change the country. Why not just change the world? You know, why bother to change the country first? You know, we have to work with the Constitution we have for the most part. We have to work with the structures we have for the most part. And so I just think, you know, I love my country. I really do. But I love its potential. I don't obviously love what a lot of people in power do with it.
Well, and yet a lot of people in power seize on different kinds of Americanisms and traditions in this country and to justify really nasty things overseas in particular.
Sure.
And so that's part of my hesitation here. To
But people do that with Christianity too. There are still people who use Christianity for good purposes.
Well, I'm not religious either, so.
Right, no, but I think, you know, I mean, I would argue Martin Luther King Jr. was a devout Christian, but I think he used Christianity, you know, in good ways. To me, I'm a pragmatist in the philosophical sense. It's the consequences of your beliefs that matter to me, not the beliefs in some, you know, overall, you know, ontological way, to use a philosophical term. So I think what matters is what you do with your beliefs. And there are left-wing Americanists, left-wing Christians, left-wing patriots who've done wonderful things.
No doubt about that. Michael Caseman, we got about a minute left. You said your whole academic life and activist life was a bit about how to change America.
Yep.
Do you have a short answer for that?
How to change America? Don't mourn, organize, to quote Joe Hill. You know, we got to be smart, but we have to be utopian at the same time.
And that utopianism, you think, has been lacking maybe up till Occupy for the last decade or so?
I think so. We got to, I mean, I call it American Dreamers because we have to dream, I think, in the American grain, but we have to dream. Because otherwise, especially for young people, you know, why are they going to join a group, a movement which just says, let's change a little bit here and there? I mean, they're idealists, and they should be.
On that note, we're going to have to end the conversation. Michael Caseman is professor of history at Georgetown and co-editor of Dissent magazine. His latest book, which I recommend, is called American Dreamers, How the Left Changed a Nation. Michael Caseman, thanks so much for being my guest.
Thank you, man.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.